Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, Israel during the Trump era. How much more bold will Israel become with U.S. full support and the do-no-wrong policy towards the Zionist state? My guest from Northern California is Allison Weir, but spelled W-E-I-R. Allison is a journalist, an author, a civil rights and peace activist, and the president of the Council for the National Interest, which was founded by several former congresspersons. She is also the founder of the organization If Americans Knew, which analyzes and reports on U.S. media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She has presented briefings before Congress on the U.S. and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. She has lectured widely at numerous universities, including Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Yale, Berkeley, and to academies and institutions overseas. She has received a variety of awards, including the Phi Alpha Literary Society for Courageous Journalism on behalf of human rights. Allison's articles frequently appear on the Counterpunch website, antiwar.com, Project Censored, Global Research, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Her book, Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, is a thorough, meticulously sourced document bringing forth a story barely known about the real history of the U.S.-Israeli relations and the origins of the State of Israel. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. Also, she is an extremely controversial person, especially on the left, which is not unusual today, since the left does not really represent true liberals, certainly not FDR liberalism. In fact, President Eisenhower had more in common with FDR than the last seven presidents. That's ironic, since he was a Republican. But what you have is anyone, and I mean anyone, who touches the third rail and criticizes Israel for any reason is immediately cast as an anti-Semite, as a pro-Palestinian supporter, and therefore the media will not touch them. They're kryptonite. I just want to give you a little idea of the support that Allison has. More than 2,000 respected activists signed an open letter supporting Weir, including former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian Territories and Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University, Richard Falk, founding member of Bereshit University Board of Trustees, and you've had activists and Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein, Palestinian Reapproachment Center director, and co-founder George Weishamati, peace activist Anne Wright, and Aaron Gandhi, Ray McGovern, Cindy Sheehan, American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, founder and former Senator James Aberesk, and many members of the JVP itself. The letter stated that the undersigned were, quote, dismayed by the recent unfounded attacks on one of the top organizations working on this issue, If Americans Knew, and it is dedicated leader, Allison Weir, and believed that the accusations against Weir were scurrilous and without foundation. So you have 2,000 respected activists from all walks of life, including professors emeritus of international law, who say this person is doing the right thing, has a long history of being on the right side of history and truth, but that still does not stop, not for a heartbeat, the ongoing attacks against her. We're not afraid to bring on controversial people. We're not afraid to bring on people who are being attacked by the left, especially now the corporate Clinton, corporate Obama left, which has nothing in the world to do with true liberalism. Nice to have you with us today, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with Gaza, because violence has reignited again. Recently, more Palestinian teenagers were shot and killed by Israeli troops, and Gazans have been staging nonviolent protest at the fencing sectioning off Gaza from Israel for many months now. The American media has been uninterested in covering this story and never covering it from the point of view of what it means to be a Palestinian, always from the point of view of how the brave soldiers of Israel are protecting their country, and that's it. There's just no in-between. It's black and white on the coverage. New York Times, Washington Post, CNN. It's a disgrace. That's my opinion. I'd like to hear yours.
I completely agree with you. It's astounding at how Israel-centric the reporting is across the political spectrum. I think that's one of the things that really struck me when I finally woke up to this issue in 2000. It's really when I started to first look into it. I don't happen to be Jewish or Arab or Muslim or Palestinian. I had been in a sort of low-level activist previously in college. I was part of the group, you know, many people that opposed the war in Vietnam and worked for civil rights. I was arrested once in a civil rights demonstration. So I'd been sort of a low-level but active, very, very committed person for human rights. And when then I raised children. I have three children and six grandchildren. I, at that time, worked on local events. But then in fall of 2000, the second Palestinian uprising began called the Second Intifada. This is just an uprising. Intifada means shaking off of oppression. And I decided to pay attention to it. I didn't know much about Israel-Palestine. I was very supportive of Israel, as most of us in America are. But I was just curious what it was about. I decided to follow the news coverage just to learn about it. My background is journalism. And I noticed that when I paid attention to the coverage, which I hadn't done before, many of us just skim some of these headlines, and I noticed how one-sided it was, that we were hearing from and about Israelis in great detail, which I wanted. I wanted the full information. But then I expected also to hear from and about Palestinians. There are two populations involved. But I noticed that very rarely came. I listened to NPR, was probably the major station I listened to. And Linda Gradstein was the main reporter then. She still is a major reporter. And I noticed that she was always giving the view of Israelis. And we were hearing about Israelis all the time. But we weren't hearing about Palestinians. Since then, I've become aware that Linda Gradstein's husband was a sniper, I believe, for the IDF. Her children are Israelis. So this is not a neutral reporter. But at the time, I just noticed that we were only getting one side, and I wanted the full picture. So I started to use the Internet to research it. And this was fairly early to do that kind of Internet research. You know, this was just starting in 2000. But by doing that, I discovered there were excellent sources of information from the region itself, Israeli media, Palestinian media, many human rights organizations were there. Individuals were sending out almost real-time reports about what was going on. And I discovered that the violence against unarmed Palestinian demonstrators was massive. Numerous Palestinian children were being killed. Many were being shot in the head. This was being documented by Israeli media as well as by human rights organizations. And little of this was coming through in the American media, both the liberal and the conservative media. So the more I looked into it online, the more shocked I was, and the more I wondered why the left hadn't been working on this issue all these years, that, you know, liberals and I think progressives care about indigenous people. We care about violence against them. We care about justice. And yet here we care about racism. And here we had Israel, based on a racist identity of exclusion, of excluding people that were not of the right ethnicity, committing violence against the indigenous population from the very foundation of the state. That's how it was created. And the left and liberals had not been talking about it. You know, a few had, but very few. So I looked into it more and more. After a few months, I decided to quit my job. I was the editor of a small weekly newspaper in Northern California. And I traveled over to the West Bank and throughout Gaza by myself in early 2001. many months before 9/11. And I saw in person on that trip and on trips since that time, Israeli violence. I saw many children who were in hospitals, who had been shot by Israeli soldiers in the head, in the eyes, in the teeth, and everywhere. I saw entire neighborhoods already in 2001 that were in ruins, that were bullet riddled. This was before any rockets had been fired from Gaza. This was many years before Hamas was elected as the leadership of Gaza. And it was already under this massive attack. It was already in early 2001 difficult to get into Gaza. The first time I tried to get in, I couldn't get in. Israel wasn't letting anybody in. A lot of people don't realize that all of the Palestinian territories, both the West Bank and Gaza, the borders are controlled by Israel. So in a sense, not just Gaza, many people now that follow the issue know that Gaza is basically a large open-air prison. But the West Bank is a more porous prison. It also, if you want to go into the West Bank, Israel controls that. If you want to leave the West Bank, Israel controls that. So I saw a really horrific situation when I went there in person. I began to read about the history of it. I learned that, as I sort of referred to earlier, that Israel was created through what an excellent historian, an Israeli historian named Ilan Pape calls it, a war of ethnic cleansing, which is exactly what it was. It was a war to get rid of the indigenous population, Palestinian Muslims and Christians. I discovered that when I was born, there was no Israel. If Palestine existed, Israel did not. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize how that Israel was a created state, a modern state created by a war, by warfare, and that the conflict does not go back thousands of years the way many people are led to believe. You know, you'll talk to somebody and they'll say, oh, they've just been fighting for thousands of years. But that also is completely false. When you look back at the history of the region, you discover that in the late 1800s, Palestine was at peace. It was in some ways what today we would probably call a multicultural land, in that it was inhabited by Muslims, Christians, and Jewish individuals. The population at around the turn of the last century, just before 1900, was about 80% Muslims living on what was called Palestine. It was under the Ottoman Empire. About 15% Christians and a little under 5% Jews, all living on the land of Palestine, large, without conflict. There are, you know, ancient churches and temples and things that you can see in that region. So there's a history here that has sort of been erased from most people's minds. Most people, I think, are not really aware of how Israel was created, of who what Palestinians are, that they are people that were living on that land. Some still remain in what is called Israel. Many got pushed out into other countries. Many live in what are called the Palestinian Occupied Territories, which are the West Bank and Gaza Strip. That's about around 20% of the land that originally they inhabited. So there's a huge history here that I began waking up to just by accident when I got curious about this issue.
You have visited Gaza in the past, as you mentioned. You know the conditions are like, well, what no American would tolerate. And the Israeli policies that have kept Gazans in concentration camp conditions. But what has the mainstream media not told us about these protests? And does Hamas have much power in Gaza now as a force behind these protests? Or are there other Palestinian forces behind them?
The protests clearly were endorsed and organized by pretty much everybody in Gaza. All of the many different civil society organizations and different factions in Gaza, just like anywhere, and all of them endorsed this march, what's called the Great March of Return. This was really clearly the people of Gaza trying what many people have, you know, always endorsed, which is using Gandhian nonviolent strategies against oppression. This nonviolence movement in the Palestinian territories, by the way, didn't start with the Gaza marches. It's been going on for many years. Every week, I've seen this in person a number of times. Every week, there have been nonviolent demonstrations in both the West Bank and in Gaza, with people, you know, unarmed people, often villagers, often farmers, often entire families. I've taken part in these, trying to use nonviolence against the confiscation of their land. They are met every time by Israeli military violence. They're beaten. Many people are injured. Quite a few people have been killed. Some of them were foreigners, so some of them we've heard about, Rachel Corrie, Tom Herndahl. Others have been injured extremely badly, have been maimed for life. So these nonviolent marches have been going on, I'm trying to remember when they start, you know, at least 10 years, and actually far longer than that, because the first intifada was nonviolent. So nonviolence has been used by the Palestinians for a very long time. The Gaza march was just going to be nonviolence on a far larger scale, where all of the people of Gaza would be organized, tens of thousands of people, to go to the border where they're fenced in by Israel, to go there, to have these camps. There were women's marches. There were women coming there. All of this, there's a great deal of video footage of this, of still photographs of it, a lot of firsthand accounts of what people have been doing. So this nonviolent march, the Great March of Return, was being publicly organized by all of the groups in Gaza, including Hamas. All were announcing that, you know, I saw the lead up to this was very public. All were announcing and recruiting people, you know, encouraging people to join this nonviolent demonstration. All of the wording for it, the messaging was that it would be nonviolent, no arms whatsoever, even though there are not many weapons in Gaza. The idea was that no weapons would be used, nobody would be armed. It would be a nonviolent march, a Gandhian march. So Israel, in response, mobilized its military, one of the most powerful militaries on the planet. It deployed, and this comes largely from the Israeli media, where this is all covered very accurately, 100 snipers gathered to shoot people, and that's exactly what they did. They've shot, by now, they've shot and killed over 200 of these participants. They've injured, I think, it's hard to keep up with the latest numbers. I think it's around 22,000 people have been injured, many of them now with lifelong injuries. Many will be in wheelchairs, et cetera. This has gone on. The first Great March of Return began on March, I believe it was 31st. And every Friday since that time, there have been massive numbers of Palestinians in Gaza of all ages gathering and having demonstrations. And they get shot at every time, and every week a few more get killed, a few hundred more get injured. The media, the Western media, the U.S. media, of course, have to cover this somewhat. It's so huge, they can't ignore it the way they ignore so much else that goes on in Palestine. But the coverage of it always, there's always a great deal of effort, clearly, to give Israel spin. It's always supposedly these are organized by Hamas, which is, quote, designated a terrorist organization by the United States. Well, if we're talking about terrorism, Israeli forces have killed many, many, many more civilians than Hamas ever has. This is a conflict, yes. both sides use violence. Both sides at times kill people. Both sides at times kill civilians. Israeli forces have killed many more people. We have all the statistics on our website, If Americans Knew. They've killed many more women. They've killed many more children. They've killed many more civilians. All of these statistics are easily available. Now and then, some place like the Washington Post for a short time had an excellent resource that gave all those statistics. So it's easy to know that, but the media never report that, almost never, with a few exceptions. They almost never put that in. They always try to emphasize that Hamas, which was elected to be the leadership of Gaza, it was the sort of dissenting view. They had been under Fatah for a long time. Conditions had gotten far worse. Most populations, when conditions are bad, vote for the other party. And that's what went on. But again, the media don't tell that. They imply that these are terrorists. This is a terrorist organization organizing people to take part in terrorist acts. Although in reality, these are the kind of nonviolent demonstrations that most Americans believe in across the political spectrum. We believe in using nonviolent demonstrations when necessary to alert people to our cause, to try to get, obtain rights, try to overcome oppression. And that's what's been going on with the Palestinians in Gaza.
Allison, since Trump has come to office, we find Israel becoming more bold, not just with respect to being more violent against Palestinians and advancing the settlements, and depriving Gazans with the basic necessities to survive, such as clean water and medicine, but also encroaching into Syria and becoming more bold against Iran and making some slight moves to destabilize Lebanon. All of this fits into the neocon agenda and the Obama agenda, and especially John Bolton, who embraces the project for the new American century, imperial hegemony, reach to effect regime change throughout the Middle East. Those in our society and around the world who are concerned about why there isn't at this point, after all these decades, peace, a two-state solution in that country. I would want a peace for both countries, but that's not the way we're seeing this. Your thoughts, please.
Well, there's so much. As you said, this is until there's some change now, but largely, both parties have been doing what Israel wants it to do. Both parties are dominated by what's called, very accurately, the Israel lobby. That's the massive donations are given to political campaigns, and politicians realize that they better do what AIPAC and the Israel lobby is far more than just AIPAC, wants them to do, or there's a good chance they'll be pushed out of office, that massive amounts of money will flow to their opponents, as it has done with both Democrats and Republicans, and they'll be voted out if they don't do what the Israel lobby wants. The earlier you had mentioned the wider plan that Israel has, that not only have the Palestinians suffered and been killed and massacred periodically by Israel, but there has been other populations throughout the region have also been severely damaged and attacked every so often by Israeli forces. This was documented, as you mentioned, there's the Project for a New American Century that wrote about this very openly. I think that was in about 1996 that started. But then this has gone back again. I've been researching this for 18 years, and I've now written a book, the first of two books that will be about the Israel lobby in the United States. And what I've learned is that this plan that entails damaging others in the region on behalf of Israel went back to the earliest days of Israel. To explain it, it's actually fairly simple when you think about it. In Israel's war of conquest, in which it was created by what were then called Zionists, a political ideology to create a Jewish state on land that was 95% not Jewish. So Zionists fought the war. It ended up, therefore, becoming Israel, and they're now called Israelis. What they did was a massive ethnic cleansing of several hundred thousand people. Some estimates even put it at 1 million people, but certainly at least 750,000 people, men, women, and children, were very ruthlessly forced out. Those people, many are in Gaza and the West Bank, but they're also in surrounding countries. They're in Jordan and Lebanon, Syria, other areas. So Israel realized from the beginning, and Ben-Gurion wrote about this openly. Others wrote about it. The first prime ministers of Israel named Moshe Sharet had a diary in which he wrote about this in great detail, that in the 1950s, they were already talking about the need to prevent other countries in that region that now had Palestinian refugees from becoming strong enough to advocate for those Palestinian refugees. They had to keep every other country in the region from potentially becoming a threat to Israel. Not that any of them wanted to take it over. They had their own plans and their own ambitions and their own countries. But they had all these refugees in their countries, and all those refugees had the right to go home. And it was likely that these countries would try to advocate for those refugees, which is what Egypt and some of the other countries did. So Israel had this plan to divide and conquer, to either buy off the countries, as it did with Egypt. It maneuvered a massive U.S. aid project to Israel, to Egypt, that continues to this day. So Egypt gets a massive amount of money. It's the second most money from American taxpayers. And in response to that, Egypt stopped supporting the Palestinian cause. Sadat tried to do that, but he didn't do it. So they bought off Egypt with U.S. tax money. They bought off Jordan with U.S. tax money. Lebanon, they've invaded a number of times, so they've caused it great damage. The countries that were left that needed to be, they hadn't been bought off, so they had to be destabilized, were Iraq, Iran, and Syria. This was written about openly in the 1950s. Well, not openly, secretly in the 1950s. In 1980, there was the Yenon Oded plan, which was an Israeli strategist wrote about a strategic plan, specifically talking about fragmenting all the countries in the region by name. Then there was the project for the New American Century that, again, talked about many of these same countries by name. So the Trump Muslim ban, as it's called, that liberals and leftists fortunately have opposed, many people don't realize that ban was begun by Barack Obama. It was his administration that chose the countries of interest that the Trump administration is banning people from. And those countries of interest are largely the same countries that were targeted by Ben-Gurion back in the 50s, by Yenon Oded in the 80s, by the Project for the New American Century and other groups in the 90s and in the 2000s. So it is a regional plan. And there are some excellent books about documenting that the reason that the U.S. invaded Iraq was largely because it was pushed by Israel partisans within the Bush administration. That's been thoroughly documented. Now, Iraq is destroyed. Massive tragedy in Iraq, that's been destroyed. That encouraged and led to extremism and destabilization, had a major impact on destabilizing Syria and causing problems there. And the country that still needs, according to this plan, to be damaged further is Iran. So we have the same individuals, the same groups that pushed for the attack against Iraq that was a disaster on every possible level. The same groups now want the U.S. to attack Iran. And we see constant demonization of Iran throughout the U.S. media.
I'd like to address the politics of anti-Semitism. I've had guests who have been highly critical of Israel periodically, such as Rabbi Michael Lerner, Uri Avnery, who recently passed, former IDF officer whistleblowers on Israel military crimes against Palestinians, Professor Francis Boyle, and many others. What I see is that this term anti-Semitic has taken on a life of its own, almost completely out of any historical and valid context, and is used repeatedly against anyone who raises any objections to Israeli political decisions and actions. There is a serious problem when criticism toward Israel's domestic or foreign policy or of Zionism as a political and not a racial or religious ideology, where Israeli opposition and oppression and the murder of Gazans is charged with being anti-Semitic. Now, you've been charged with this also, and perhaps that was one reason why Jewish groups managed to have you and Mark Crispin Miller canceled from speaking at the Left Forum this year. And if that's true, I would never again mention, promote, or myself lecture at the Left Forum. But now, government policy against any statements against Israel that can be distorted to refer to anti-Semitism is becoming law. You wrote about this last year when South Carolina, a staunch evangelical Christian and Republican state, tried to pass legislation to adopt an Israeli-centric definition for anti-Semitism. Now, this is another form of censorship, and it would apply to university campuses, where these kinds of debates about Israel and Palestine should take place in an open, civilized manner. That would be banned. Professors could not teach about the Israeli conflict or Israeli-Palestinian history. That could be banned. Of course, I don't expect anything to happen on Pacifica because it bans crap all the time. Such hypocrites. But what can you share about how the term anti-Semitic is a concerted, intentional propaganda and media ploy that has become institutionalized almost as a psyops procedure by the Israeli lobby and political Zionist organizations that attack its enemies and marginalize its critics from public space?
That's exactly what it's done. As you've guessed, the minute I started talking about Palestine and Palestinians, I was called anti-Semitic. Even before I was aware of the power of the Israel lobby, and even before I talked about the Israel lobby, I didn't yet know about it. As soon as I just described my trip, my first-hand trip traveling around Gaza, I was immediately called anti-Semitic. This is how it works. An Israeli Knesset member on Amy Goodman's show a few years ago said, it's a trick. It's what we always use. As soon as somebody's critical of Israel, they're called anti-Semitic. This is exactly what happens. What's happening now, bad as that was, and it's pretty horrible because nobody likes being called that name. It's, you know, an extremely offensive suggestion that you're a bigoted individual, which fortunately my life history shows that I oppose bigotry of all kinds. But it's gotten even worse than that. That wasn't enough. Now, Israel partisans are working very hard and succeeding in codifying a new definition of anti-Semitism. Not the traditional definition is prejudice or bias against Jewish people. Now they're saying they're expanding it so that there are certain statements about Israel. About half the definition that's now being used by the U.S. State Department, for example, talks about statements concerning Israel that supposedly constitute anti-Semitism. This is a campaign that began about 20 years ago. As you said, I've written a long article where I go through step by step, and I always cite my material so people can look at my sources of the information. It began with a formulation created by an Israeli minister, an Israeli official, came up with a new formulation of a definition of anti-Semitism that has now been adopted in European countries, in European transnational organizations. Hannah Rosenthal adopted it for the U.S. State Department, so now people call it the, quote, State Department definition. It was, as you noted, it's been inserted in South Carolina. by South Carolina legislators who did not understand the significance of what they were doing. I interviewed quite a few of them. It's being down at the level of college campuses. Some small college campus in the middle of the country are now, quote, adopting what they call the State Department definition of anti-Semitism. Once that's adopted, that means that lectures about Palestine, information about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, that of certain types will be called hate speech and therefore will be prohibited and will be censored. There's a bill trying to put that in the federal government. So far, it has failed. Sometimes Israel partisans realize that they're going too far. So there's sometimes a debate going on. It's going on right now on a lot of issues between the hardcore right-wing Zionists and the liberal Zionists. The liberal Zionists, I tend to think, they're not as harsh, which is good. They're smarter, and they're a bit insidious. So some of the liberal Zionists, and to me it's an oxymoron. A Zionist is somebody who's believes it was acceptable to ethnically cleanse people, and it is acceptable to profile them on the basis of their ethnicity. I find that abhorrent. But a liberal Zionist finds that acceptable. But at least they don't think that we should censor things as much as the hardcore Zionists want to do. And at least they don't want Israeli policies to be as harsh as the hardcore right-wing Israel partisans desire.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a clip, not a long clip. It's about 30 minutes long. Chris Hedges and Professor Norman Finkelstein. Finkelstein is despised in Israel and by the entire Jewish lobby here in the United States. But listen to what he has to say. You can agree or disagree, but at least see if you find reason in what he is suggesting.
Israel keeps 2 million Palestinians in Gaza trapped and surrounded in the world's largest concentration camp. It uses its military to shoot and wound unarmed protesters, destroy power plants, schools, medical clinics, apartment complexes, and hold villages. Robert Piper, the United Nations Coordinator for Humanitarian Aid and Development Activities, said in 2017 that Gaza had a long time ago passed the unlivability threshold. Youth unemployment is at 60%. Suicide is epidemic. Traditional social structures and mores are fracturing, with divorce rising from 2% to 40%, and girls and women increasingly being prostituted, something once seen only rarely in Gaza. 70% of the 2 million Gazans survive on humanitarian aid packages of sugar, rice, milk, and cooking oil. The UN estimates that 97% of Gaza's water is contaminated. Israel's destruction of Gaza's sewage treatment plant means raw sewage is pumped into the sea, contaminating the beach, one of the very few respites for a trapped population. The Israelis have not even spared Gaza's little zoo, slaughtering some 45 animals in the 2014 assault and leaving it a mangled ruin. Joining me in the studio to discuss Gaza and Israel's policy towards the Palestinians is the country's foremost scholar on the Israel-Palestine conflict, Professor Norman Finkelstein. His latest book is Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. First of all, as somebody who comes out of the Middle East, I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I spent 7 years there. This is probably the most important book I've read on Gaza, hands down. I have a kind of emotional favorite, which is Joe Sacco's Footnotes in Gaza on the 1956 massacres, which you, the Fateful Triangle, but it is an extremely important work. And as somebody steeped in the Middle East, I can't stress enough how important what you've done is. What you do in the book, which I think is so important, is that from 1948 onwards, the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians fits a very identifiable pattern over and over and over and over. And you walk away from the book and it just implodes the Israeli propaganda and the Israeli lies, including this latest massacre, the eighth massacre since 2004. Talk about what that pattern is.
Well, I think the pattern is pretty straightforward. The pattern is Israel likes to say that Arabs only understand the language of force, and it's really a projection of their own mental outlook. They believe that the Arabs in general, and Palestinians in particular, only understand the language of force. And so the when it comes to Arabs in general and Palestinians in particular, the Israelis have only one tool in the box, and the tool in the box is to inflict massive death and destruction to put the population in line. There's really only one signal.
But it doesn't work. I mean, like, as you point out in 56, they went into Gaza and killed hundreds, especially in Khan Yunis and other places. I mean, this has just been, and they are quite open about disproportionate force, which means lethal force against unarmed civilians. In the case of Gaza, they were literally lining up people against the walls and gunning them down. And yet, 50 years of this, it's not worked.
Well, I don't really agree with that. I think it has worked. Israel has managed to sustain the occupation of the West Bank and of Gaza for a half century. There are periodic moments of resistance by Gaza. Israel then, as it says, it goes in and mows the lawn.
Right.
The consequences for Israel are relatively minor, trivial, you might say. And then Gaza stays quiet for several years. And a pattern has developed where whenever the Gazans or the natives become restless again, Israel goes in to mow the lawn. So I think we shouldn't be too sanguine about a people's power to resist.
Let me just throw in there, because I think a lot of people on the outside, when they hear about it, the refugee crisis, don't understand that in order to create the Jewish state, there had to be an expulsion. There were, 1 million Palestinians in Palestine. If they weren't expelled, the Jews would have been a minority within their own state.
Right. Well, that's the... it's not what you would call a radical opinion. The Israeli historian Benny Morris, he writes in his expanded version of his book, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Question, the expanded version is revisited. He says that the idea of transfer, and transfer is just a euphemism for ethnic cleansing, the idea of transfer was inbuilt and inherent in the idea of Zionism for the reasons that you just spelled out. It was impossible to create a overwhelmingly Jewish state in an area which at the time was overwhelmingly
That was just a brief clip from Chris Hedges on RTV speaking with Professor Norman Finkelstein. And we're back. I want to go back to Allison Weyer and get your thoughts on this, because Finkelstein can't get lectures. No one will debate him. Chris Hedges can't find any place in mainstream media that will allow him to debate or share his points of view. So that blockade of intellectual discussion is complete. So could you take us through? Could you take us through now what you see happening? I don't know if you can answer this, but I want to share this on the program. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz did an investigation back in early 2017 and found that the Kushners, Trump's son-in-law, family, had contributed $250,000 to the ultra-Orthodox Chabad movement. And the paper also found that Trump's foundation donated small amounts over the years to three Shabbat organizations. And this was even before Ivana married Jared and then converted to Judaism. Now Shabbat is part of the international organization, one of the most conservative in the world. You wrote about Shabbat's late head, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, and his followers regard him as a messianic figure and a mystic. And this is a huge organization globally, very powerful with considerable wealth. The U.S. government has regularly honored the head with announcements of that they will not attack them, even though there are people who say that the teachings are extremely racist, particularly with respect to genetics, and Shabbat would be the equivalent of America's most fundamentalist and militant evangelicals if we had to find a comparison. So share a little about this man's teachings and how influential is Shabbat in the United States, and do you feel that they are one of the puppet masters behind Trump with respect to his Israeli-Palestinian policies?
Well, it's certainly very different than the veneer people think that Chabad has. It's around on college campuses. I speak at different campuses, and you know, often in the student union or something, and I will see that there's a student Chabad group there. So, it's what's astounding is that the person who really grew Chabad, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing this well. It's Chabad. I believe it's pronounced Chabad, basically. It looks like Chabad. So one of a person that really has grown this into probably the fastest growing Jewish movement in the world, maybe one of the fastest growing movements in the world, was a man named Menachem Mendel Schneerson. He's also known as the Lubavitcher Reb, which means a special kind of rabbi of an especially fundamentalist version of Judaism. He taught many things. You can see videos of him online. He's pretty much always speaking in Hebrew, as I recall. And he gets quoted periodically saying good things, fortunately, beneficial things that sound wise and that probably everybody could endorse. But he also had many statements and many teachings that were not translated into English that were profoundly supremacist. It's really astounding. But fortunately, there was an Israeli activist named Israel Shahak, who was a highly regarded professor and scientist, who was very anti-Zionist, and he translated some of the works by Schneerson and other fundamentalist rabbis in two books that he wrote. One is called Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel. The other is called Jewish History, Jewish Religion. So because of Shahak, we learn some of these things that Schneerson taught. Before I tell a few of those, it's important to realize that Schneerson now has a day in honor of him in the United States. There's a day called, I think it's Education and Sharing Day, that honors Schneerson. Well, Schneerson didn't believe in education, and he was quite a racist individual in some of his teachings. Let me see, I can just read you a few of the quotes here. But it's pretty, very shocking, because he founded schools that still are going today that often don't even teach academic subjects. They don't teach history, they don't teach science. There are people that are went to those schools that have spoken out that they did not receive an education, and yet they still exist in New York because of the power of this lobby that prevents them from being shut down the way they normally would be. So a few of the things that Schneerson taught, and some of his followers, he died a while ago, consider him the Messiah. Some consider him godlike, that he's supposedly divine. There are over 3,000 Chabad institutions around the world. It's a huge thing. So one of the things he taught was, quote, the soul of the Jew is different than the soul of the non-Jew, unquote. He spoke that the DNA was different. He said that, quote, this is what needs to be said about the body. The body of a Jewish person is of a totally different quality from the body of members of all nations of the world. The difference in the inner quality between Jews and non-Jews is so great that the bodies should be considered as completely different species. You know, this goes far beyond any other kind of fundamentalism I'm familiar with. He wrote that, quote, an even greater difference exists in regard to the soul. Two contrary types of soul exist. A non-Jewish soul comes from three satanic spheres, while the Jewish soul, supposedly, he writes, quote, stems from holiness. He goes on and on. He talks about the difference about embryos are different. DNA is different. And these teachings are, they don't damage us in the United States. I mean, I think it's damaging that people would be teaching this type of thing. But it's dangerous in the Palestinian territories, where there are people that believe this type of thing among the armed settlers in the West Bank that have the power of life and death over Palestinians there, that are often protected by the Israeli military. So people with these types of beliefs, and that's, you know, this is not the majority of settlers, fortunately. It's certainly a small minority of Israelis, but it's a powerful minority. And in the settlements, it's quite a powerful minority. So you have this type of individual with these types of teachings, with guns, with rifles, with military power in the West Bank, and Palestinians being victimized by them. That's why it's especially significant, I feel, to know about this particular part of this particular Chabad type of religion.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us, and I also appreciate you taking your time to come on today and share some insights, because we're not talking about these issues in our society. And shame on us for not having the courage to do it. We certainly have outstanding journalists who could do this if they chose to. They just don't want to. So thank you for standing up, Allison Weyer, and giving us your insights. Her latest book, by the way, is Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. All the best to you, Allison.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Brother, 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 there's far too